processes and what is it that we need to do. We thought the minister will be here. She tendered her apology that she's attending an AU summit in Ethiopia, Addis Ababa. We might as well remember that she's the former chairperson of this important body within our continent. But we also have received the apologies from the two deputy ministers. I will, on behalf of this committee, take this matter up with the minister and the deputy minister to indicate to them that we send the program timelessly to them. It is a yearly program. They know what is it that is needed, what is it that is expected of them, and it's quite important that the meetings of the committee are not only diarized, are important. They are important meetings so that they bring about the relationship, a good working relationship between Parliament and the executive. We need that. We need to work together. And as I indicated from the beginning, we need to hold the executive accountable. And it is only through these interactions and platforms that we are going to know in precision what is it that is happening and how we can go about improving the situation. For now, let us accept the apologies. As I indicated, I'll take the matters up with them and engage with them on these particular issues. Here from Honorable Michalakis before.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm not going to say too much about it because it's not the way I would like to start. But yeah, there are two deputy ministers and there's a minister, so it's three members. But while you take it up with them, will you also please take up the fact that I have not received a single written response to any questions that I asked to the minister last year. So it's a general problem of accountability to this committee. If you don't respond to written questions and you don't come to the committee and your two deputies don't come, it's not a question of being busy, it's a question of not being willing to be held accountable. In that case, I actually hope that they actually ask her to return to Addis Ababa and she doesn't even have to come back.
This is okay. I take the point. We will follow that up. But the DG, as well as the parliamentary liaison officer, are also part of the meeting. They will note that up and accordingly follow up those particular matters. Let us quite briefly, what do we do? Introduce ourselves in the new year. Just quickly. So that I know that I've invited quite a lot of people so that we just verify in that sense. Let me start with members of parliament. As you know, I'm China Dodogu. I'm the chairperson of the select committee. I will start with Honorable Sheikh this way and end with Honorable Vandabella.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I'm Sheikh Sheikh, a member of the committee from Limpopo.
Good morning. My name is Usonyuta from Eastern Cape. Good morning. My name is Pindile Mola from Mpumalanga.
Good morning. My name is Karim Sese. I'm from Eastern.
Good morning. Khuyamora Molweni, Isaac Mbulelo Sileko, Western Cape.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm George Michalakis from the Free State.
Dumelabo Melwentate, lebitso la ka ke Kenny Motsamai, go tswa kwa Gauteng.
Good morning, Chairperson and members. I'm Simon Fire from KwaZulu-Natal.
Morning, my name is Sam Zandamela from Pumalanga.
Okay.
We'll start with Honorable Motswana from the Northwest and allow anyone to introduce himself very quickly so that we know who's here and who's not here.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. My name is Aaron Motswana. I'm the Chair for Cooperative Governance in the Northwest Province. Thanks.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Maggie Govender. I'm representing the Chair of COPTA from KZN.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Tavon Motswana, Chair of COPTA.
Any chair of the committee from the provinces? Is that okay? Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. My name is Masho Asedipofa, Director General of the Department of Traditional Affairs. So perhaps, Chairperson, with your permission to save time, I can quickly introduce the rest of the colleagues that are with us. Clifford here is with other traditional affairs, dealing with the current parliamentary and cabinet liaison. Dr. Kenny Govender is from the Department of Cooperative Governance. He is the one. I used to work at DPFA and we had Kenny Govender there. So Dr. Kevin Naidu is the acting deputy director general at DCOC. He's actually the one who will be leading the presentation on the local government side. And then Abraham Stoll is the secretary of the National House of Traditional Leaders with the team here. And then Babu Kumalane, yes, he's with DCOG as well, which is in the same section as Dr. Kevin Naidu. Tricia here is our legislative drafter, a director at the Department of Traditional Affairs. Now, next to him, we have Darishi Guri. He's a deputy CEO of the IEC. The bill on local government that is going to be tabled, there are areas that the IEC has sponsored because it deals with a lot of issues that relate to elections. And then, of course, lastly, Vauktoban Matela is from the ministry dealing with the parliamentary and cabinet layers. That's the team from our side, Chairperson.
Anyone who would like to be introduced in the meeting? I know that there are quite a number of officials here. Are you all okay? Just quickly, Mama. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Good morning. My name is Mary Mage, and I'm also with the COPTA team.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much for that. Let's start with the first presentation on the objectives of the customary initiation bill. This bill is very, very much important. Given the situation that is unfolding there, sometimes there are lots of deaths that are happening and there need to be checks and balances, people held accountable, be sure that we're doing this properly within the parameters of the law, of the constitution, and also important of our culture, our custom, and our tradition. Over to you, DG.
Thank you once more, Chairperson. The bill before the committee is the customary initiation bill, and the Chairperson has already underscored the importance of this bill. So this slide just deals with the scope of the presentation and the introductory remarks that we will make, the journey that we have traveled from the stage of a policy to where we are now with the bill, and then dealing with the substance of the bill, the objectives, the content, the consultations that we've been through thus far, financial implications, and some concluding remarks. By way of introduction, Chairperson, you've already indicated the significance of addressing matters relating to customary initiation. It's a customary practice, but unfortunately it's been subject to abuse. We hear of very unfortunate reports every time we've been through a winter or a summer initiation season of initiate dying, of casualties, of initiate amputations, all sorts of sad stories that we hear associated with the practice, and we believe that one of the weaknesses it's ineffective regulation. Although there are provincial pieces of legislation that address themselves to this matter, to date there isn't a national law that speaks to customary initiation and which therefore provides norms and standards that can cut across all provinces. You can go to the next slide. Just the journey that we have traveled to get to where we are today. Previously, as a department, we were involved in conducting research relating to customary initiation. The research that we did culminated in a policy which was submitted to Cabinet in 2012. But Cabinet requested us to do further research. After we did the further research, we then went to Cabinet in April 2015, where we submitted the revised policy, and the policy was approved for publication in Government Gazette for public comments. We revised the policy after receiving the comments from Cabinet, and in April 2016, the policy was approved. Policy on the customary practice of initiation in South Africa. But in addition to approving the policy, Cabinet directed that we should then take a step further and come up with draft legislation based on the principles that are contained in the approved policy. So this brings us to where we are today, where we have the customary initiation bill, which we drafted, and in June 2017, Cabinet approved that it be published for public comments. That was done. Cabinet then approved it for tabling in Parliament on the 28th of February 2018. A little later in the presentation, we will then talk about the process that followed once it was taken to Cabinet, to Parliament. But let me just talk then about the objectives. Critically, here we are trying to protect, promote, and regulate. And these are the three operative words that we need to emphasize here to ensure that they are acceptable norms and standards that are applicable across provinces, and also to ensure that there are specific structures that are established at national and provincial level to ensure that there's proper oversight, proper coordination, and that initiation takes place in a safe environment. We seek to provide for the protection of life. We seek to provide for clarification of responsibilities, who critical role players are, and as I indicated earlier, effective regulation of initiation schools. The different chapters of the bill has five chapters. The first chapter deals with matters of interpretation, definitions, what is an initiate, what we mean by initiation school, what we mean by abduction, because we deal with those issues, what we mean by kidnapping, what we mean by a medical practitioner, and so on and so on. It also deals with application, where we indicate that it applies to all initiates, irrespective of gender or age. It speaks to those objectives that I've already mentioned around the protection of life. And then it also deals with prohibitions, where we specifically indicate that there are certain people who will not be allowed to be role players in this process. So people, for example, whose names appear in the National Child Protection Register, people whose names appear in the National Register for Sex Offenders. These are critical provisions that have not been provided for before to ensure that initiation is practiced in as safe environment as possible. And then it also deals with guiding principles, key amongst which is to make sure that whatever gets done is done in line with the Bill of Rights contained in the Constitution. The next chapter, Chapter 2, talks about the structures I was mentioning. So The bill establishes the National Initiation Oversight Committee, and this is the composition of the committee, the National House of Traditional Leaders, Civil Rights Commission, our department, the police, health, the Department of Women, National Prosecuting Authority, the traditional health practitioner councils, and if deemed necessary, not more than two experts who are experts in those areas of anthropology, customary law. What are the functions of the National Initiation Oversight Committee? Those are contained in the next slide. The functions are of an oversight and monitoring nature. They provide guidance to provincial structures, which we will speak to, conduct inspections and investigations, oversee awareness campaigns relating to initiation, and operate an initiation hotline. The chapter also then deals with the a composition in terms of the provision that there will be a chairperson, there will be a deputy chairperson, disqualification from membership, what gets done when there are vacancies in the National Initiation Oversight Committee, how the committee will function in terms of the meetings that they will be conducting, and the fact that the department will then provide basic administrative and financial support to the committee. At a provincial level, which is on the next slide, then we'll have provincial initiation coordinating committees, and we indicate that the composition there, that there will be not more than 11 persons, but we distinguish between provinces where there are provincial houses of traditional leaders and where there aren't any. For example, in Gauteng, there isn't a provincial house of traditional leaders. So we indicate that where there are provincial houses of traditional leaders, the membership will be as reflected there, the provincial house itself, provincial government, municipalities, emergency services, and traditional health practitioner of the province, who is a member of traditional health practitioner council. So where there is no provincial house, but they are recognized traditional leaders, again, the example of Gauteng, where they are recognized senior traditional leaders, but there isn't a provincial house, then in the space of the provincial house, the national house of traditional leaders comes in. And then you have the rest as contained in A above. C deals with in a province where there is no provincial house and there is no recognized traditional leader, the composition of the Provincial Initiation Coordinating Committee will be as reflected there, the National House of Traditional Leaders, and then the rest as reflected in A above. The next slide deals with the functions of the Provincial Initiation Coordinating Committee, which is to consider applications to hold initiation schools. This is a very critical, chairperson, because the provision here is that for you to operate an initiation school, you must register. And the committee will then deal with applications to hold initiation schools. So they will do the registration as well. They will come up with criteria and requirements for initiation schools. Where necessary, they will close initiation schools that are not in compliance with the provisions contained here. They will conduct investigations, do awareness campaigns as well. They will also keep a comprehensive database per initiation school and develop manuals relating to roles, responsibilities, duties and of the different role players, the principals, the traditional surgeons, the caregivers, and the traditional health practitioners. They will also report abuse of initiates to the South African police so that the necessary action can take place. And register traditional surgeons as well. We also make provision for technical support teams that a provincial initiation coordinating committee may establish. Those technical support teams will be consisting of representatives of various relevant departments, health, social development, arts and culture, and so on, but they may also co-opt other people at national level, departments such as justice and constitutional development and so on, to be part of the technical support team, and of course perform other functions as may be delegated to it by the Provincial Initiation Coordinating Committee. Chapter 3 of the bill, Chairperson, deals with the responsibilities of different role players. The expectation on government side is that we will establish the two types of structures that I've spoken about, the National Initiation Oversight Committee and the Provincial Initiation Coordinating Committees. We will promote partnerships because to deal with this matter, it will involve partnership with other role players as well, and then overall control of the initiation schools. The houses of traditional leaders, national and provincial, they have the responsibility to promote the customary practice of cultural initiation, to also assist in the criteria for screening of principals and caregivers. Traditional leaders themselves, overall responsible for the initiation practices in their areas of jurisdiction, conducting inspections of initiation schools, and the screening of principals. And then principals and caregivers responsible for all other aspects relating to initiation schools, while the caregivers are responsible for general care of the initiates. We also have parents or legal or customary guardians who have a responsibility to deal with the initiates, where whether he should attend initiation school or not, the decision that must be taken, and must also make sure that they obtain a certificate from a medical practitioner declaring that the initiate is fit to undergo initiation, because it is a requirement that before an initiate undergoes initiation, they must get a certificate from a medical practitioner declaring them fit to undergo the practice. But should the initiate fall sick, the parent or legal guardian has the right to attend to the initiate who falls sick and may even remove the initiate from the initiation school under certain circumstances. Traditional surgeons, they must be registered and they must perform circumcision as prescribed in the legislation. And then medical practitioners who must be registered, they issue medical certificates in respect of initiates and may perform circumcision as prescribed, because there are certain areas where the actual circumcision itself may be conducted by a medical practitioner, and this is provided for in clause 28 of the Act. Finally, the South African Police and the National Prosecuting Authority, they must conduct investigations where there are alleged transgressions of the law, and the NPA must decide whether to prosecute or not. Chapter 4 deals with the actual initiation schools themselves, that they must be registered if they comply with prescribed criteria, that the registration itself is not a permanent registration, that it gets renewed, it's valid only for a specific season, that if the initiation school is going to operate in a certain land where the owner needs to be approached, and they must make sure that they indeed get the permission of the landowner to hold the initiation school there. But provision is made in the bill that official school terms must not be interfered with. So initiation season may not interfere or overlap with official school terms. The next slide deals with the issues relating to consent, prohibitions, age, and circumcision. Critically, it is a voluntary practice, and no person may be forced to undergo initiation. An initiate may only undergo cultural initiation if the necessary consent has been obtained and all the consent requirements have been complied with. So, for example, the issue of having a medical certificate that says you are fit to go through the practice, if it is not there, then you may not attend initiation school. Then there is the issue of minimum age of initiate, that the minimum age is 16. It may be higher based on provincial preferences, and here we are doing it based on what the Children's Act says. The definitions that they use there. The next two bullet points then we just distinguish in terms of the issue of consent, that if the initiate is 16 to 18, consent must be given by initiate and parents. 18 or older initiate without necessarily the parents or guardian. So the point that I've mentioned about the Children's Act, we confirm the provisions of that Act, so that issues of genital mutilation, of virginity testing, circumcision, we confirm what is contained in the Children's Act relating to this aspect, and especially the point that no consent may be in contradiction with the provisions of the Children's Act. So, for example, even if consent is provided for somebody below the age of 16 to undergo customary initiation, it will not be allowed, even if consent is provided. If consent is provided for genital mutilation, the provisions of the Children's Act apply, because the fact that you provided consent doesn't mean that the parent or the legal guardian then is allowed to go outside the provisions of the Act. Next slide deals with the male circumcision. It is to be done by registered medical practitioner, or it should be done by a traditional surgeon. But when it is done by a traditional surgeon, it should be a traditional surgeon who is also a registered medical practitioner. Or if it is not a registered medical practitioner, does the circumcision under the supervision of a medical practitioner. This is a very strict requirement that the bill provides for. The bill also deals with the consequences here. So a person who forges any consent is guilty of an offense. And that's why we talked about the South African police and the MPA as role players here. Again, consent initiates should only go to registered schools. So just because you are a parent, a legal guardian who gives consent, you can't give consent to your child to go to an unregistered initiation school. Prohibitions, no initiate may be assaulted or abused under the guise of discipline. We have read reports of a lot of initiates dying due to dehydration during the summer season in the Eastern Cape. Principals must therefore ensure that water and sanitation needs are catered for. And where there is a death of initiate, it must be reported immediately by the principal and investigated by the South African police. Chapter 5 of the bill deals with general matters. We deal with these matters because they have financial implications, so we indicate with the National Initiation Oversight Committees the issue of allowances and expenditures. A number of the people who will be members of these committees will themselves be, some of them will be government employees and so on. So the issue of those kinds of allowances do not necessarily apply because they will be employed. But for those that are not in that category but are members of this committee, provision is made for such allowances. Critically, imprisonment provided for. 15 years imprisonment for holding non-registered initiation schools. At the moment, we have generally a problem in some of the provinces in particular where year in, year out, every season, they are unregistered schools. And once this is enacted, then it will be captured in law that if you run and do not register initiation school, you will get 15 years in prison. But we indicate also that this clause in the bill does not replace the offences that are provided for in other laws, the Criminal Procedures Act, the Children's Act, and so on. Where somebody wants to, for example, register and the provincial initiation coordinating committee turns down their application to register, those kinds of decisions by either the national structure or the provincial structure, the bill provides for processes where you may appeal to the premier, for example, in the province. The bill also makes provision that the minister might develop regulations that will support the implementation of the bill, and the fact that our department and counterpart departments in provinces will be responsible for monitoring the implementation of the bill. The bill also provides that there are certain differences in different provinces that provinces might need to provide for. And I think it's an issue that we raised earlier that, for example, where we talk about the minimum age being 16, in a province they might decide, well, unless you're 17 plus, you will not be allowed. That space is created for provinces. We are aware that there are pieces of provincial legislation that are already in existence. To the extent that those pieces of legislation are not in conflict with what is proposed here, some of those structures may provisions may continue to apply. It also makes provision for provinces to establish local initiation structures, so the bill only goes up to provincial initiation coordinating committee, but provinces may want to take it further down at a local level and create initiation structure there. And also there's provision made for the provincial initiation coordinating committee to delegate responsibilities, roles and functions to municipalities. We then turn on to the consultations that we have taken this policy through from the time when it was developed as a policy. Extensive consultations were undertaken during the development of the policy. So in the memorandum on the objects of the bill, we provide a comprehensive list of all the consultations that have taken place during that time. And in May and June 2016, the bill was referred for comments to the National House, to provinces, including provincial departments responsible for traditional affairs, responsible for health, responsible for social development, and so on. It was also referred to the Financial and Fiscal Commission. It was also referred to a number of national departments and Chapter 9 institutions as well, and comments were received as we reflect there on the slide, at the bottom of the slide, the comments that were received. In June 2017, it was approved by Cabinet for publishing so that we could get public comment, and it was indeed published in July 2017 with a closing date of August 2017. There we just list the institutions from which comments were received relating to the bill. I will not go through all of them. But perhaps just to emphasize that we have been humbled by the support overall received for the bill. Where questions have been asked has been around the age, to say, can't we lower it down? And we've always said, here we are guided by the Children's Act. And unless there are amendments to the Children's Act, it will then be difficult for us to lower the age. But we have taken up this issue with the Department of Social Development to say comments have been raised about this particular aspect. And of course, one of the issues has been the Eastern Cape in particular around, does a traditional surgeon really need to be supervised by a qualified medical practitioner when they do what they have been doing over the years and they've learned the trade from their father and grandfather and so on and so on. But that's an area where, unfortunately, if it is left open, we will continue to have these kinds of problems. But other than that, I think there's been overall support for the bill to deal with these problems that we are facing in the sector. In terms of finances, because we say that the majority of members of the structures will be government officials, public office bearers, and Chapter 9 institution employees, the issues of remuneration and so on and so on then do not apply. But because there might be additional members who are not government officials and so on, which we say that may not be more than two, then our minister and the Minister of Finance may determine the allowances that are provided. But in any case, these are not really full-time structures where the cost would be prohibitive. And then in terms of providing for admin support to the two structures, the national one and the provincial one, it will be between ourselves, the national department, and the respective provincial departments to make provision for travel and accommodation expenditure for the members of these committees. Chairperson, just to conclude that this bill deals with matters relating to culture and traditional leadership, which are both listed in Part A of Schedule 4 of the Constitution as functional areas of concurrent national and provincial legislative competence, which is why from the National Assembly it has now been referred to the National Council of Provinces, and the expectation here, the primary role is to protect but also regulate. And we emphasize protect because initially there was a concern among some that the bill seeks to destroy the cultural practice of initiation, and we were saying quite the opposite, that actually we seek to protect it, but in a regulated manner to deal with the kinds of problems that we have seen taking place over time. It was concluded in the National Assembly where the second reading debate took place on the 4th of December 2018, and it's now before this committee for consideration. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right, thank you very much, DG. I think it was very comprehensive, enlightening, and quite good to understand the situation and what is it that we need to do. Members, it's up to you for questions. I start with Honorable Sheikh, and I follow the queue.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank the department for that comprehensive presentation. Clearly, this is an important piece of legislation, and I think it will go quite some way in terms of addressing the challenges of initiation schools, as well as curbing the gaps of our initiates. Chair, the question I'm asking is, I know the Act establishes the PICC, which has the responsibility of opening initiation schools, closing, investigating, etc. But in terms of the Act, what are the monitoring mechanisms that oversee these schools? And how does the PICC get to a situation where they would close the school? And it can't be through investigations where incidents go wrong and it's some kind of reflex action. You did also mention that while it establishes the structure, provinces are expected to take the process further. And I want to know in what, just in terms of the monitoring mechanisms, is this actually left to provinces to deal with that? The Act also has certain exclusions when it even relates to the issue of age. I think for religious and other purposes, circumcision, I mean, can take place. So then to what extent does the Act also regulate those persons or institutions that perform such circumcision practices? Thanks.
Thank you. Honorable Nita, you want to have a bite? Are you okay? You okay? Sure. Good. Honorable Mula, are you fine? Good. Honorable Fessa, really, women are fine on this matter. Yeah, okay. Honorable Siligu?
No. Ngozi Salo. No, mine basically, Chair. It's just a few questions of clarity. Because of understanding what we are facing and what we've been dealing with for the last few years. The issue of consent. How sure are we going to make sure that Umbulelo Sileku did not forge signature kamama ke okanye signature katata ke? Because you need to understand that some of us stay with ogogo bethu that earns pension, that are illiterate, that depend on us, that trust us. But because of peer pressure, we will do things, steal ID document, and then we'll forge signature because we want to go to the initiation school. So I just want to see the practicality of it. How are we going to make sure that Ugogo Silego did actually say, Mbulelo, you can go. You meet the right age. I just want to clarify on that one. And then we talk about medical practitioners. Then I ask myself, so it can be any medical practitioner. It can be Karin, who's a medical practitioner. Or must it be Chairperson Dodove in terms of gender? Can someone just clarify? When we say medical practitioner, it can be Karin, as long as you're a medical practitioner. And also in terms of respecting the culture, then I go to the question of saying the ones that must be supervised because they've been doing this thing for years. So then I ask myself, if someone that must supervise has never been to the school, is that person going to be allowed? Because we understand the culture most. There are boundaries. I just want clarity on that one. And the issue of access that is given to legal guardians. So if I stay with my gogo, and unfortunately I get sick, and the bills make provision that Ugogo can come and fetch me. So are you actually saying Ugogo will be given access to the school, understanding the boundaries that we have within the school? It's just questions of clarity. Thank you very much.
Honorable Mika Lakis.
No question.
Okay. Honorable Mutamai, I'll come back to you. Honorable Mutamai.
Ekare kya khotso fala hanyane a golo ka bilena e le go so di mayo e ya khotso fala ga ile gore batho ba rona le bona ba tla tsala access ya hore a le gore re na le dingaka tsa setso di sangoma le tsone di tla kgona go recognize gore a e le gore di ka kgona go chesa le tsone meriana bone dimpepa mo ditleliniking yalo nka e thabela.
Honorable Fire. Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I want to appreciate the job well done by the department, because there were talks that this culture might be abolished, but you have found ways and means to restore it. That was the job well done. And also I'm happy that during your hearings, you spoke to Amakhosi, because this culture belongs to them. it's their culture. And they are the custodian of the culture. And on your presentation, you have mentioned that you had a chance to talk to Amakhosi about your bill. But I want to check on this medical practitioner. That what do you do with them? Do they examine the person before the exercise, or they examine him after the exercise? Because the condition of a person must be known before the practice? That's my question.
Honorable Zandavela, or are you okay?
No, I'm joking. No, I'm covered. Actually, mine was just on the composition of the medical practitioner. The issue of gender, I think there was a question that was raised. Mine was on that. Thank you.
Good. Honorable Nita?
Chair, I want to follow up on the issue of the medical practitioner. I want to check. You talk of medical practitioner. Certain you also have abantu ethical maybe. Never. Where do they feature in the picture? Because you don't want to lose the part of the Tangayo that fire the culture, maintaining the culture in the process of ensuring that you make sure that you cut down on death and any other challenges that they experience there. Yes, you need people that are trained medically, but at the same time, you want to keep the culture as it is. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Nita. Honorable Mwanga.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to ask this question because now in the initiation schools, there are people who are stealing our children and take them to the initiation without our consent. What is happening? Because if we are saying they must have letters, but they stole them. In the last initiation, my sister's child was stolen, and he came back, and I don't know how, what happened, because the police have to go there and fetch him. Thank you.
Honorable Professor?
Sorry, Chair, on second thought, listening to everything and being a mother, I'm just thinking about one thing. You say you're using, there must be a general practitioner must be present there. But what about the circumstances where these operations take place? Is it sterile? What are the conditions of that? Because in most of the cases, people die of septicemia and stuff like that. So how do we protect these youngsters against practices like that so that they are in a sterile environment where they can get best conditions and not be subjected to infection? Thank you.
Well, thank you. Can I chat with our provincial chairpersons and members of the legislature if they have some comments? Okay. So, tell Baba.
I see that there is a mention of the question of the
Chair, Section 23 of the bill does make an appreciation of the role of the traditional surgeon. However, the limitation in the composite clauses that are reflected there is it does not explain when the traditional surgeon is illegal, does not have the proof to show the committee. And the provincial the PIC decides to close his school. What happens to that person? Because the biggest elephant in the room is that issue. Let me just Chair, through your permission, illustrate this a situation that happened in Limode. This old man could be above 67 or so, almost 70. The community, in particular women in that community, believes in that man.
when police came to close with the provincial leadership of traditional leadership and ourselves, a group of women in the location came to say, stop this. You can't close. We trust this man. So there's something that, in my view, must be very explicit. There must be no ambiguity about this person is found not to possess a legal document conferring him that he is a traditional surgeon approved. There must be consequences in law. In this case, they are not very, very clear for me. The other point is age. Some of the boys, because of what we know in the country of unemployment, the majority of them become the traditional surgeon. The act must have something that talks about age, in my view. I still believe, as a Xhosa person, traditional now, that I cannot, before 50, become a traditional surgeon. I think we must determine age for a traditional surgeon, because remember, this person would have undergone a lot of phases, seeing many boys during his time. And I think we should say something around that issue, Chair. The other point is overcrowding. So the issue is space now. The bill must talk about space. When you say the DG spoke about the environment must be conducive, the initiation school, conducive must be unpacked. Not, of course, in detail, but to give clarity around the issue of the space, somewhere in Tofimba, in the Crestline region, during December, I went there with the committee. I found in three rendezvous, each had about 96 initiate. 96. With, of course, many members had to wear masks when they get in because it's health hazard, given the temperatures. The temperatures that we have. So for me, I would think that people are just making money now because one initiate, if this traditional surgeon is a school and it has 296 of initiates, each paying 2,000. He says that man goes home by end of December with almost R1 million. You can take your mathematics, your arithmetics, those who went to school before me. It will take you to almost over 600,000, almost R1 million. Of course, you don't even count those who do the work and leave. You're counting only the 296 remaining. In a very overcrowded environment. So for me, there must be something that talks to space. The last point. You close initiation school for two reasons. The traditional side is illegal. The initiation school is illegal. It's not confirmed. What protection in law is there when you move the initiates outside that place to a health facility? What protection in law that you have? Remember, you could be taking somebody who's already ill. And that colleague may be worried that this person may have something on the road. The traditional said they may say, I left that person well. He dies on the road. The act, the bill in its current form does not talk about that issue at all. And in my view, it's an issue, it's an elephant in the room again, Chair, that with the committee, when you go there, you've got worried. You have to close. You take the traditional surgeon, the issue for you is, what are you going to do with these kids? What happens if on the road something happens? So something must be found somewhere to protect the committee so that it's not left vulnerable in doing its work in the province. The last point, Chair, would be, I would not say it's great work. Of course, the team has done its work, but provinces would have made such submissions. I would not imagine that they would be jettisoned to a summary by the department. I would want a feedback to say, all of the submissions made by provinces was the bigger scale of things, where they covering all the aspects, so that we are not subjected to a technical, you know, reflections of the technocrats, as it were, having been on the ground and knowing the situation, as it were.
Honorable Mutuan.
No, thanks, Chair. I'm covered by the submission from the Honourable Member from Eastern Cape. To a large extent, the experience is similar to our province. I would want to comment just on part two of the bill itself, that we emphasize that the police should not come as part of the establishment of a technical support team. Because in most of the cases, there's a delay when you want to involve subs in terms of now having to relocate where a committee would have arrived at the conclusion that the initiation school is illegal. Sub will then bicker around issues of not understanding the tradition very well and so on, and in such a way allows a situation where people take advantage and as a result end up exploiting the fact that SAP does not want to immediately act. My take would be that at the establishment of a provincial committee, SAP should form or a designated officials from community safety. Now, in other provinces, it might be that those people are sitting. But in the Northwest in particular, we have a situation where subs only comes at a level where you call them. And in most of the time, the processes become tedious. There's a situation where, because of the ambiguity of the law, a person who operated in a illegal initiation school took the province to court and won simple on the basis of technicality. So on that particular part, I think they should start being informed from the onset so that they understand the implication of what is needed to be done. There's also provincial policies that have been established by various provinces to regulate whilst there was no actual act that was guiding. I take it that we should emphasize that the act now has to supersede those particular policies that are in provinces, because still those particular policies were vulnerable to exploitation as it is. The other issue is where the bill on clause 22 mentions that in the event that a parent is concerned of the safety or an initiate is killed, such parent or a guardian, a legal guardian, reserve the right to go and remove. It borders on issues of now trampling on the cultural issues and traditions and norms as we practice them, that any person, to that effect a woman, can conclude that in her absence an initiate has gone to a traditional school and for various reasons would want to go in there using the very same, to me, it provides for a technicality, because then a person can then at all time claim, because the law allows it and so on and so on. So it should be the responsibility of the responsible provincial committee and the local ones that would have such powers to remove eventually in that particular case. But leaving it like that would always create an opportunity for people to want to play technicalities. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jefferson. Two things. I may have missed it, but is there any regulation of fees charged by initiation schools? Because I think that should be something to be considered as well, because there could be an abuse of communities. And then the second one I see is covered in, it was the issue of circumcision under the age of 16 for religious reasons. But I see that it is covered by the Children's Act. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Responses, DG.
Thank you very much, Chair. With your permission, I think if I could just ask my two colleagues to take a bite and deal with the issues that they might have been left out.
Gato was DG.
Can
you tell us in the chairperson? and greetings to the honorable members of this committee. Chair, I'm going to try and answer as much as I can. I may not follow the questions as they were asked. But maybe let's start with the broad principles. Here we're talking of customary initiation. So there are other issues that are there customary depending from community to community that happens prior to initiation. I'm trying here to answer the question of ugogo being illiterate and so on. You go to the community Yamandebele, for instance, and the same to community Yabatebu in Eastern Cape. Before an initiation takes place, there is this process, Amandebele, they're calling it Ukonga. The group of young men who will be undergoing initiation, they group themselves during the day and then all of that. You distinctly see them, that they are going to undergo initiation, those boys. That's the first point. Then the second point is that other communities prior to that, you will see them wearing, I think about members who are coming from Mpumalanga will know, Amandebele, they will put on something on their forehead which shows what is this boy is going for an initiation school. So there are very little chances that, forging is forging, criminality is criminality. You can't say it will not happen. But communities have foreseen such, and culture created that situation which is a person who's going to undergo initiation. There are certain preconditions, customarily, that he or she must undergo prior to initiation itself. Now, Chair, that's the first thing that the custom attempts to address before we even coming to the written notice that this person has been given e consent. Now, secondly, Chair, on that one, on customary approval. When you go to communities like, I'll make an example, Amandebele, because I know them better. When a child is undergoing initiation, the traditional leader or the headman who's delegated will inspect the boys and check if they are grown up to an extent where they can undergo initiation. That is why there is this saying that Amandebele, I'm taking this boy to initiation, Ikosi is unborn, meaning the traditional leader is the one who will say, no, this boy is grown up, he can undergo initiation, or no, he must go back home, he's still young. So those are issues that are put in by custom and cultures as prohibition for a young person to undergo initiation. Now, Chairperson, let me now deal with the others. Now, the medical practitioner must declare the boy fit or the child fit to undergo initiation. There's this that we call pre-medical inspection prior to initiation. Before this boy undergo initiation, he must go to a medical practitioner to check about high blood, all those things, if the boy is fit enough health-wise, is healthy to undergo initiation. If there's anything that is not healthy in that particular person, the medical practitioner will indicate what is this boy has this condition, and therefore that condition must be taken care of. That is why we're saying if circumcision happens, there must be a qualified medical practitioner who's there, so that if the medical certificate that the boy has obtained prior to that, the medical practitioner is able to interpret that, because traditional surgeons may not be able to interpret those medical terminologies and the like. So that is one other matter that we're trying to keep, we mustn't have ama challenges. Hence we're saying the medical, the traditional surgeon in the EV must operate under the supervision of the medically qualified doctor. But the condition of that medical qualified doctor is that he must have undergone initiation. You cannot just take any medical practitioner who has not undergone initiation and say, you go and you go to the bush. No, he will remain there as well until the rest come back. Because if you have not undergone initiation, you can't go to initiation school and come back. Now, the question of access now comes in. Now, the child is sick. Now, he must be taken out. Now, here is how the custom has made provision for such. As ugogo, or as a mother, or a single mother, who wants to take a child to initiation school, the mother will talk to the uncles who will be responsible for that child. There is no child who just falls from heaven without any uncles, abo malume, abo babomncane, and all those, or any close blood relatives. So they are taking care of that boy. So if there's any access to that school, those abo uncles are the one who will go and get the child out of that school on the instruction of ugogo. So that is how the custom has made provisions for such. And such things you cannot say in the bill, Uti, our uncle must go, because you don't know who of the relatives, close blood relatives who are there, who will be identified to be responsible for that child. Because when a child goes to initiation school, there's a certain person who's responsible for that child in that initiation school. Now, that is the access, Chairperson. Amakosi were indeed consulted, and they did buy into the whole atmosphere, because the biggest problem that we have is that we're trying to keep deaths from our initiation schools, because as I think we have DJ mentioned earlier on, you have this challenge, which is if a person dies with initiation school, then you look at, was the initiation school registered or not, and was the person who's there supervising qualified enough? Because you cannot come out of initiation school this year and next year you are the principal of an initiation school. It cannot happen like that. That is why we have made provisions that you must at least be 40 years or at least have overseen or have participated in not less than 3 seasons of initiation, so that you get enough experience to know what when a child behaves like this, this is how you must treat him. When a child behaves like this, this is how you must... That is how you learn. There's never ever been a mkhugi. You just don't become an mkhugi all of a sudden. You have to undergo training, because as an initiate yourself, you may not be able to understand how is it to be on the other side and looking at the taking care of the initiate. And Chairperson, here I think we did mention what in terms of agenda. Any medical practitioner can check the health of a person, any medical practitioner who is qualified. But the one who will go to the initiation school must be a person of the same gender and who has undergone that practice. You will not just take any person who is male to go to the initiation school. Surely, I must be honest with you, he may as well remain, because of one thing. You will just not enter initiation school if you don't know a certain code that is used in that community to get into that code, into that school. That is how custom has made ama provisions. You must just not have somebody who doesn't have a clue about the custom claiming to come and monitor or whatever, or just come to see, because there are people who want to see what is actually happening there in the Boma. They just have that interest. So there is a code. If you don't know that code, you will not be allowed to come in. Instead, they will take you to a traditional leader where you will be fined. Would you try to go to a place where you are not supposed to go? So you will therefore be fined. Because when is an initiation season, the community is informed, the community is aware with an initiation season, that part of the area is now restricted to the initiation schools. Now that covers the environmental part of it and so on. Now the issue of kidnapping is a very serious challenge. It's a very serious challenge. It happens now. You find what if a person is kidnapped from one township, say in Gauteng, taken to Limpopo, where he gets initiated, and then thereafter is placed in Mpumalanga. I'm just mentioning these 3 provinces because there's a place where they almost meet. You may not know whether you are in Limpopo, you are in Mpumalanga, or wherever you are. So there's then this issue of provinces having to come together, but we have closed that gap now. there's a sound working relationship between structures of traditional leaders and monitoring team. Because this has been happening between Mpumalanga, Limpopo, and Gauteng, wherein you find we've got that kidnapping that is taking place. You even go to areas like Abo Kokstad, which initiation does take place, but kidnapping does take place as well, but it happens very minimal as opposed to the Gauteng issues. Gauteng covers as well the Free State part, because you find others are from Free State, they get kidnapped to Gauteng province or Gauteng to Free State province. That is where we have this problem. But we believe with this bill, if it's passed, it's going to help us because of the powers that will be given to the different structures that are established. Chairperson, yeah. Now, if a person, the example is when we honourable member Matiwan, the community has passed to this person, and this person has an initiation school, and they've given that person their children. Yes, we appreciate that. But if the law says register, irrespective of the trust that they have to you, you have to register. Otherwise, you are guilty of an offence. I know there are many honourable and trustworthy people out there whom the community trusts, but because we are making that provision, and as the bill provides, which is there will be outreach in terms of radio and all of that, in newspapers that say, if there's anyone who wants to render this service, please register. That person will have that particular time to register as well. We have a problem of overcrowding, yes, but in a legal structure, overcrowding is always prohibited. If you have too many initiates, you break them down into a smaller group that will be easy to manage. You look at the initiation schools, Zabapedi. There you find 300 children in one camp, not in one hut, in one camp. They are properly taken care of. They have their, for easy understanding of the honourable members, I'll call it chalets, temporary chalets. They have temporary chalets that they sleep in a very organised and conducive manner that takes care of their health and takes care of their protection while they are sleeping. Remember, they are in the bush, there are snakes, there's everything. So as a principal of the school and as a person who's taking care of those initiates, you need to make provisions for all of that. And I like what Baba said, Babu Mzama, he said the traditional sangomas will now have a way. Yes, they will have a way. Because there's this belief, Chairperson, that initiation to a large extent, when you have a good inyanga, not even a bird will fly over the initiation school. That bed will fall down and there and there. So, Chair, we believe Houthis and with the Traditional Health Practitioners Act, we will have them and they will assist in that. Now, Chairperson, ISAPS, as honourable members have indicated, ISAPS is involved from the beginning, even now as we speak. They are sitting, the ISAPS and NPA, they are sitting in the different committees. And when we have to intervene in an initiation school, SAPS is always there. When you go to Free State in the past season, a number of initiation schools were closed, including Gauteng. They were closed because SAPS was playing the role. And if SAPS is not, we have a direct line to the national office to give instructions to that particular police station to act immediately. So up to now, there's a lot of a sound working relationship that is there with SAPS. But we're saying SAPS must be much more active. But Chair, the issue here is that SAPS may arrest a person. And after the initiation season, when that person is going to appear, you find out the initiates, or people who were initiates at the time that person was arrested, they don't want to come and testify. Therefore, the case falls off. That's the only challenge that we are having now, Chair. But again,
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's one of the things. Thank you.
And a few contributions again?
Yes, please, through you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members. I think Mr. Sithole said a lot. I just want to add a few more points. With regard to access to the school, the bill also makes a specific provision to say that there must be a designated sick area, which could be away from where initiation practices is taking place, which means that if any go-go, anybody wants to access the child, they're not necessarily going to go to the area where initiation is taking place. Then with regard to the medical certificate must be done at least 21 days before initiation. So we can't have a child that was examined a year before and then produces that medical certificate to say that he was fit. So it must be a fresh medical certificate. With regard to the regulation of fees, the bill specifically provides that the minister will determine what fees will be paid by whom and the amount. So that will be done through a negotiation and consultation process with the National House of Traditional Leaders as well as the Provincial House. And then I just want to quickly touch on a few other areas. With regard to abduction and kidnapping, it's a specific offense in this bill. So any person that who has been regarded as contravening the act will be prosecuted and investigated. With regard to non-registered traditional surgeons, it's also a specific offense. If the person is non-registered and claims to be registered, it is made a specific offense, guilty of an offense in terms of this bill. With regard to overcrowding, when a principal applies for registration, the PICC must determine how many initiates must be in a particular school to prevent overcrowding. And the PICC must also determine how many initiation schools will be allowed in a particular area, again, to prevent overcrowding. When a school is closed illegally before the initiates are transferred to another school, they must be examined by a medical practitioner to make sure that they are fit to undergo further initiation. If they are not fit, the bill specifically provides for the parent to be contacted so that the child can be removed. I think that's my contribution. Thank you.
Chair, I think
way forward.
Yes, I think maybe just two, because I think the issue the Honourable Shade raised about actual monitoring mechanisms practically. I think starting the process with registration, because prior registration, the committee must satisfy itself that we have a proper qualified person in terms of age, experience, and all those kinds of things. That way the initiation schools will take place is in an environment that it satisfies them. And then also that the permission of the landowner has been obtained. So starting from the time wherein registration takes place, and then the bill provides for actual inspection, that they go in and inspect to check, are all the kids here, was legal consent obtained, medical certificates, all the compliance registers, they check the checklist thing, and they will have to do that periodically so that throughout the initiation season they are able to satisfy themselves that these issues are being adhered to. Perhaps just finally, Chairperson, to say from here, and I know the Honourable Member raised the issue about what do provinces say, and I think because the committee will then direct the process of further engagement. But as I indicated from our side, it's been overall support except for the two issues. The one is age, because there are provinces that are saying 16 is too old for us. We want to be allowed to lower the age. And it might be something that comes up again. But as indicated, because of the restrictions placed by the Children's Act, we were not able to amend that. And that's still subject of discussion between us and the Department of Social Development. So it's something that might come up again when the committee engages with provinces. And then, of course, secondly, the issue of traditional surgeons. To say, why should the traditional surgeon do their job under supervision? That was particularly coming from a certain province where the belief was that let traditional surgeons do what they know best. But again, given all the problems we've been experiencing, it was just going to be difficult for us to leave that without making that kind of provision. But our team will be available to work with the committee and our counterparts in provinces as the committee decides to take the consultation processes forward. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right, thank you very much. And thank you very much for the responses to the questions. I think this is the beginning. That's where we started. From now on, we are going to unfold the parliamentary process, which our intention is to ensure that it culminates into the passing of the bill itself. And our view is that this must happen this year because the process is long overdue. And we are going to do everything within our power to ensure that we indeed fast-track this process until it reaches its final conclusion. We are going to place the adverts in the papers where we invite the written submissions from people about the bill itself. I'm told that the process takes about 14 days. Thereafter, we are going to consider the comments and views expressed by the public. Once we are done with that process, the 6-week cycle will kick in, which will entail engagement with different stakeholders, including in our provinces, when which we are going to have public hearings in our provinces to solicit their views, their comments on this important piece of legislation. That's my comment on the presentation itself. I think a lot of members have indicated that this was a good presentation. Yes, it was good, it was comprehensive. But in my view, it lacks some information that needs to be forwarded. We need to know what is the current state of affairs with regard to our initiation schools. How many deaths per province? And what course of actions are we taking on a continuous basis? For me, that is quite important to get a sense about what is happening today in all the provinces. For me, that is quite important because we all know that the media has got a great deal of interest on this matter. Our people have got a great deal of interest, especially when deaths occur in these schools. And for me, that is quite important to get a global picture about the current situation, what is happening in terms of all the issues that were brought to our attention. For me, that is quite important so that members of parliament are empowered about what is it that they need to do, especially when they are going to engage in their respective provinces. For me, that is quite important because here, this bill, as important as it is a new beginning altogether in terms of what was happening in the past, in terms of our tradition, in terms of our culture. Now, all of this is now going to be regulated, and for me, that is quite important. But immediately after all this process, we are going to expect the department to begin the process of community education, so that we educate our communities, outreach programs must be unfolded so that everybody understands the bill. It's comprehensive, it's very big, it clearly spells out the role of different stakeholders, what is it that needs to happen, the structures and the institutions that must be set up, the registration of different players, and so on and so forth. And for me, educating our communities about all of this is quite important because this represents a major shift, a major change in terms of the practice of the past. And all of this, because now they will be regulated by the law, they ought to be thoroughly and deeply explained to our communities. On that note, DZ, thank you very much for your submission. We are now going to take the second submission, the second and the last submission, which is on the amendment to the Municipal Structures Act. It is also an important an important piece of legislation. The process is also detailed. It marks another process itself since the Municipal Structures Act was passed around 1998. And there are lots of changes, lots of proposals that needs to be taken into consideration. DG, over to you again. You will designate the person responsible to facilitate this. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Our acting deputy DG, Dr. Kevin Naidu, will lead us in the presentation.
Thank you, DG.
Thank
you, DG. Good morning, Chair and honorable members. I was actually just looking at the Act here, Chair, and it says that the date of commencement was 1 February 1999. So Structures Act is almost exactly 21 years old. Chair, my presentation is going to focus on, give you a brief background as to the what is contained in the presentation. A part of the presentation also deals with a high-level overview of the amendments, and then the second part deals with further details relating to specific amendments and clauses in the law. So, to say that initially, when the amendments that were coming forth around the Structures Act, they were mostly informed by proposals that were coming through from the IEC. Now, on the slide, you will see that in 2000, we had 60 by-elections for that entire five-year term. In 2011, we had 741 by-elections through that entire third term of local government. As we sit here today, in the present term of local government, we've seen 341 by-elections. We've just given you those figures, Chair and members, to show you how the system of local government has been evolving, the contestation that happens in that sphere of local government. But as time went on, the need for more amendments had grown, and SALGA, the departments, provinces, and some municipalities had also begun to raise issues. These issues related mostly in terms of strengthening oversight and governance, but also to promote certainty on some provisions that reside in the Act. To arrive at the point that we are at, we have undertaken various consultative processes and engagements with various stakeholders. So when we had gone to the Portfolio Committee in 2018, the committee had scheduled engagements with various stakeholders, and we had presentations that were received from SALGA, the Demarcation Board, the COPTAs from KwaZulu-Natal, Western Cape, and the Northern Cape, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, IEC, as well as the department. And this happened over the period 13, 14, and 20 November of that year. We had also received written inputs from the Free State COPTA, as well as the Mpumalanga COPTA. The committee had also issued an advert in the newspapers with a closing date of 30th of November. Suffice to say that no submissions were received, and we had continued the deliberations on the bill in early December. And through the entire process of deliberations, we had made 20 changes to the clauses from the bill that was submitted to Parliament. In February last year, the bill was debated in the National Assembly, and it was thereafter submitted to the NCOP for concurrence. After the elections of May last year, the Minister had written to the NCOP to consider the bill further, and the bill was subsequently revived by the NCOP on the 17th of October of last year. So the bill has 32 clauses in it, okay? And we've categorized them into three areas. The first area deals with electoral-related amendments. The second deals with governance matters. And then the third area that we've categorized these amendments, we refer to as other matters, as they mostly deal with amendments of a technical nature. In the ensuing slides, you will also see that the various clauses have been color-coded. So when you see the orange color there, it would be amendments of a technical nature. When you see the blue, it would be amendments of a governance-related nature, and the green indicates those amendments of that were sponsored mostly from the IEC. So the next five slides, including this one, gives you a very high-level overview of the amendments. And if you look at the very first clause there, impact defined, so where you would see it in red, it would mostly mean that that definition was as a result of engagement at the portfolio committee. If you look at clause 7, for example, you would see there the minimum of 15 councillors in a local municipality or district municipality was changed to 10 in red. So as a result of engagement in the portfolio committee, we had moved from the 15 to the minimum of 10 in a municipality. Further, if you look at the local municipalities underlined there, that was lacking in the bill version that was submitted to the committee. We clarify that after discussion that it is only in local municipalities greater than 20,000 kilometers where you can have such a deviation. So the next slides are dealt with in the similar fashion, and the red, as I've indicated, was as a result of engagements that had taken place in the portfolio committee. So I'm going to go to the section that deals with the detailed information relating to what sits in each of these amendments. And if I go to this slide, for example, it would be slide 14 in the version of the presentation that you have. And when you see the green block there, that green block basically indicates that which stakeholder has sponsored the amendment to the Structures Act. So in clause 1, for example, all of the amendments that you see there were as a result of engagements or recommendations that came from the departments, provinces, the IEC, and SALGA. And then to take you to the first issue of around the term declared being defined in clause 1 of the bill. So you would know that there were challenges around indicating exactly which date councillors would take as being declared elected. Some municipalities would take the date of the election. So, for example, if we had elections on the 3rd of August 2016, the elections, some municipalities took it as the 3rd of August as the date of the election. Other municipalities took it as the date of the publication of results by the IEC as the date being the date of being declared, whereas other municipalities took the date of the first council meeting as the date of being declared. So we've clarified that, and we're saying in the law now, we're proposing that the date of publication of results by the IEC would be the date that a councillor is declared elected. So you will see in the ensuing slides, specific clauses have been amended to be aligned to this definition. And when I come to those slides, I will just skip through it. In this first clause as well, we've deleted the definition of district management area because it has become irrelevant, it has become obsolete because there's been a process to do away with district management areas. There's a definition of WIP, And as I come to that section in the presentation, we will say why we've included this definition. We've also now included the definition of impact, and I will elaborate that at the appropriate time. So clause 2 deals with district management areas, and as I've indicated, it has been obsolete, it has been done away with. In addition thereto, in 2013, the reference to DMAs in the Property Rates Act was removed as part of the cleaning process around the matter relating to district management areas. Clauses 3, 4, and 5 deal with types of municipalities, and we've deleted subsection 7C, 9E, and F of the Act so that the type of plenary type of municipality is now become obsolete. We will not have a plenary type of municipalities going forward if the proposed amendments are accepted. And one of the reasons for doing away with the plenary type of municipalities is around the challenges experienced by this type, including the limiting of executive authority to the full council, and because it is unable to delegate executive responsibilities to any individual councillor or to any of its committees. Clause 6 is also of a technical nature, and it gives effect to the removal of reference to district management areas. Clause 7 deals with Section 20 of the Structures Act. It deals with the determination of the number of councillors in a municipality. And this clause was mostly sponsored by the department in consultation with the Northern Cape COCTA. As I've indicated earlier, the initial proposal was that it be 15. After engagements, it has become 10. But in addition to that, we've now included a further criterion around size of municipality to be considered when an MEC applies its mediation requirements. So presently the requirement is that an MEC may deviate by 10% when determining the number of councillors. We're saying that it could be 20% if the size of municipality is greater than 20,000 kilometers and if less than 35 councillors have been determined for that specific municipality. So if you look at this slide, for example, it shows you the 9 municipalities that are greater than 20,000 square kilometers in the country. And if we take Dawood Kraper municipality, and let's say the formula gives you 30 councillors, presently an MEC may deviate by 10%. So if the MEC deviates, it can go from 30 to 33 councillors. But the same, in this instance, because it is more than 20,000 kilometers, the MEC can deviate by 20%. May seem a lot, but if you do the sum, so rather than going from 30 to 33, the MEC can go from 30 to 36. So that would mean instead of having 17 wards, you would now have an extra ward, 18 wards in that municipality. Just some information. The city of Johannesburg is actually 1,645 square kilometers, and it would be able to fit 27 times into the Dawood Kraper local municipality. I spoke earlier about the minimum of 10 councillors, and if you look at the slide here, these municipalities, if the number was 7 to 9, these municipalities would now have a minimum of 10 councillors there, and a corresponding 5 wards. Clause 8 deals with a providing of a cooling off period for a councillor. So if a councillor is removed by an MEC in terms of a breach of the code of conduct, such a councillor presently could go to another municipality, stand for election, and become a councillor. And the same, going forward, that there should be a 2-year period for such a person to be eligible to become a councillor again if removed as a result of a breach of the code of conduct. As I indicated earlier, this clause deals with an alignment to the definition of declared elected. I'm not going to go through it. This slide deals with the technical removal of the definition of the MA. I'm not going to go through it. Clause 11 deals with by-elections. And one of the amendments we are saying is that the MEC may not call a by-election within 9 months and not 6, which is presently the case. This section in the Act also says that the MEC decides that the by-election must stand over until the next election of all municipal councils. We've put in the rider that says MEC can only do this in consultation with the minister. The next slide deals with vacation of office, and it is a technical alignment where we're migrating the code of conduct from the Systems Act, Schedule 1, into now the Structures Act. We also provide for a subsection which has a cross-reference to the Electoral Act, the definition of authorized representative, and we're saying that only an authorized representative as defined in the Electoral Act of 2000, as amended, may inform an MM that a vacancy has arisen in a municipality. You may know that from time to time, the IEC would receive representations or requests from unauthorized persons indicating that a vacancy has occurred in a municipality, which may not necessarily be the case. So we're trying to fix it through this intervention. This clause relates to the MEC being able to intervene in instances where the speaker or acting speaker or MM or acting MM refuses to call a meeting. So through this process, we're hoping that an MEC can intervene and call this meeting so that a council can continue dealing with its business. The section here deals with the migration of a section, section 19, I think it is, from the Systems Act into the Structures Act, where we include a new section that deals with notice of meetings. The section that precedes this is also deals with meetings, and we felt that it would be a good fit to have this as part of the scheme of provisions in the Structures Act. The next section deals with quorums and decisions, and we're saying that we're clarifying that in this clause that when a quorum is being decided upon in a meeting, the number to be considered is the number that the MEC determines in the Section 12 notice at the time of establishment of a municipality. So before an election, an MEC publishes Section 12 notice, and in that notice, the MEC will say that this municipality has 20 councillors. So that is the number that will be considered when a quorum is being determined for the meeting. The next provision here deals with a matter relating to non-uniform application of the law. So in some instances, municipalities thought that a chairperson or presiding officer had a casting vote on any matter. This matter ended up in the Constitutional Court, and the court confirmed that when it comes to the passing of bylaws, the approval of budgets, imposition of rates and other taxes, the raising of loans, presiding officer or chairperson does not have a casting vote in those instances. So we're just regularizing, reading in the words through this amendment. This clause here deals with a technical alignment to the deletion or the doing away of the plenary type of municipalities, and we're saying that a councillor may not hold office as speaker or mayor in any municipality in the future. We've included in this clause functions of a speaker, or we added, and we've indicated these four sub-items into the functions of speaker. And the intention of this proposed amendment is to ensure that we strengthen the role of the speaker in the municipality and to promote proper functioning of the different arms of the municipality. Clause 18 deals with an amendment of Section 41 of the Act. We provide for a new 41A to 41F dealing with WIP. We know that municipalities have WIP, but we found out that there is no departure provision in the law that actually provides for the creation of the Office of WIP. So we provide for a very detailed section in the Act that provides for election of WIP, functions of WIP, term of office, vacation, removal, and acting WIP. The next section deals with the composition of executive committees. Presently, there is no uniform formula that determines the composition of executive committees. We are now prescribing a formula which is in alignment with another formula in the schedules to the Structures Act, so that we now, going forward, have a uniform formula across the country when it comes to determining executive committees in municipalities. The next section deals with the functions and powers of EXCOs, and we read in certain words where we require these committees to forward these reports together with recommendations to the council. And the practice is that in some instances, EXCOs and executive mayors stifle reports of oversight committees, as they say that they must go through them first so that they can deal with the matters and that they only need to take it to council if they deem it necessary. The point raised was, who will forward the report implicating themselves? So this provision or proposed amendment is with the aim of rectifying that. The next section deals with functions and powers of executive mayor, and we're saying that an executive mayor is entitled to receive reports from Section 80 committees, to forward these reports together with a recommendation to the council. The next section clause deals with ward committees. Presently, there is no time frame for municipalities to establish ward committees. We're now giving them 120 days for municipalities to establish ward committees after the general election of all municipal councils. The next clause deals with providing for a new Section 79A in the Structures Act. Section 79 presently deals with committees of council. We are now creating the establishment of an oversight committee in municipalities. We're doing this with the view to taking governance to another level, escalating it, and providing for this specific committee. We give the functions of this committee and what should happen to reports that are processed by the Municipal Public Accounts Committee. Importantly, we are saying that in the proposed amendment, that reports of the Municipal Public Accounts Committee must be submitted to the Speaker, who must table such report in the next meeting of the Municipal Council. In the next meeting of the Municipal Council, but not shelved somewhere so that things are not processed. Section 81 deals with the participation of municipal councils by traditional leaders. So at the time that the bill was developed, the Traditional and Khoisan Leadership Act was not an act. So the proposal in the bill as it stands has now become irrelevant, and the Department of Traditional Affairs has picked that up. They've drafted amendments, and they will submit same at the appropriate time for consideration by the committee as the structures bill gets processed further. The next section is a technical amendment, and it is part of doing away with the reference to district management areas. So to the next slide, which is technical in nature, dealing with reference to the plenary type of municipality. Clause 27 deals with the excessive seats, and this intervention is aimed at prescribing a procedure for the redistribution or recalculation of seats when it comes to an election of municipal councils. Clause 27 also deals with giving a time frame to parties, a time frame of 2 days to supplement their list. Presently, the legislation is not prescriptive on the time frame for parties to supplement such lists. Clause 27 further deals with requiring that a vacancy be reported within 14 days and not 7, which is presently the case. It is also aimed at ensuring that the MM does not inform the IEC of a vacancy, then the MEC must intervene and inform the IEC of such a vacancy. Clause 27 further also deals with providing that a party may not supplement or change its list from the date of the close of candidate nomination and may only do so after the results of the election have been declared. This clause 28 is aimed at ensuring that candidates act swiftly to enable the IEC to expeditiously finalize matters on the side. That is, if a candidate is assigned to more than one seat, then he or she or the party has 2 days to inform the IEC of their decision. The next clause, 28, also deals with multiple seats. Currently, the legislation is not prescriptive on the time frame for parties to supplement their lists. We're giving them now a time frame to ensure that this happens quickly. The next clause, the next proposed amendment also deals with the matter around district management areas, and it's technical in nature. Clause 29 provides for an insertion of WIP into definition of office bearers. So WIP is also now included with mayor, executive mayor, deputy mayor, and deputy executive mayor. Clause 30 deals with the migration of the Code of Conduct from the Systems Act into the Structures Act, because we believe that it is a better fit in the scheme of the provisions in the Structures Act. Clause 31 is also technical nature, and it indicates that Section 19, that is Notice of Meeting, and Schedule 1 of the Systems Act is repealed. And so too is Section or Clause 32 of the Bill, which deals with the long title of the Act. Chairperson, that is the contents of the bill, clause by clause. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Very comprehensive, very detailed, and it also usher in a new approach, new interventions to municipalities, more especially in relation to how the municipalities must be structured and must be functioning. And that intervention is very much important, given the experience of the last 22, 21 years since the Municipal Structures Act was promulgated in 1998. Anyway, from the IEC, in relation to the aspects which affect the elections, all right, wonderful. Now, to members of parliament, any questions, comments, contributions? Where do I start? Again, Honorable Sheikh. If you don't have anything
to say. Thank you, Chair. I don't necessarily have a question, and I'm not sure if you want me to make comments, but. Chair, I think the presentation was quite clear, but in addition to making municipalities function more efficiently, I think this thing of the separation of powers at the level of municipalities was a very important aspect, and I think this bill goes quite a long way to addressing that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mita.
Let me also follow my colleague in appreciating the presentation, which is quite straightforward, Chair. But I noticed that he has also mentioned the issue of the demarcation board. Now, I thought, Chair, in talking on the demarcation board, when we deal with the issue of the amendment of the bill, we'll also talk about the time frame now that we are considering in terms of redemarcating municipalities, because we have been crying that municipalities are forever in transition, because you have this demarcation, this term of the municipality again in the next term. How I wish the bill will also talk of a term that is more than the term of the municipality itself. You would say maybe in 10 years' time we redemarcate, so that you allow the municipalities to stabilize and finish the program that they are doing. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Mona, are you good? Covered.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with the demarcation board interrupting municipalities like they are at the moment. And what they do is they interrupt these municipalities in the board. Nobody can establish that the thing is going there, because then it's interrupted. And you put in a rural area with a town area, which is sometimes difficult for a municipality to comply with activities. Thank you.
Honorable Silico, are you covered? Or are you what?
I won't be long.
No?
Yeah.
Thank you for the presentation. And let me start with MPEG. I welcome the function that MPEG is going to get more functions now. But one thing that is missing so that we can be happy, because we've been on oversight in Section 139 interventions. And where we'll find that the chairperson of MPEG is from the governing party in most municipalities that are in disarray. And the bill does not say anything. It does not dictate who should be the chairperson of MPEG. As the presenter was also saying, in terms of oversight reports, that it shouldn't go to the MEC, to the EMC, or to the mayor. It should actually go straight to council. Because why should I actually report myself? Because so how can you be a player and a referee at the same time when it comes to MPEG? That's where we find the problem. And also, what is the department going to do when some municipalities does not follow in terms of MPEG, the establishment of MPEGs? Because there's a lot of legislation that we're supposed to follow and we don't follow, and there's no consequent management. Because you will have MPEGs, but they are not fully capacitated, so they cannot fulfill their responsibility. Now you are saying you are giving them extra functions, but you are not saying that it must be fully functional. Should there be external experts to assist councillors in fulfilling these responsibilities, understanding that most of councillors are illiterate, and it's not their fault, it's because of where we come from. But how are we going to make sure that they fulfill their responsibility to the best of their abilities if they are not assisted by experts in terms of the work that you're actually saying that they must fulfill? And the second one, I would just, before I continue, can I just ask a question of clarity? When you talk about the EXCO, are you talking about the mayoral committees? That it must... Executive committees.
Okay, no, that's fine. And also in terms of the financial implications of these municipalities that are going to be enlarged, because in terms of what you're saying is just to deepen democracy, are we not going to make these municipalities to be more and more broker, because currently everywhere in South Africa, the majority of municipalities are broke. They don't have money. They are not sustainable. And now we are saying let's broaden the number of councillors. And who's going to fill that bill? You know. Let me end there. Thank you very much.
Honorable Mutsamai, any point?
Yes, let me just say I have a problem with some of the municipalities where they are corrupt, and our people, they're expecting to get just a basic water. That's the basic right, a water. And you will find there's no water, the municipality is so corrupt, and there's no roads, there's no houses. But and we come and look on this bill. I think, Chair, we must call those corrupt municipalities so that we can deal with them. And to look on this, this is a very serious issue that needs us as a community to deal with. I thank you, Chair.
Yes, but remember, this process is about the bill which seeks to amend the Municipal Structures Act on how municipalities must function. But you're right, at some point we need to interact with these municipalities to hold them accountable. It's okay. Honorable Fire. Honorable Zandamela.
No, thanks, Chair. Mine is just on clause 19 and 20. Since now they've explained ESCO, what is ESCO? So I'm a bit lost with the formula. How is it formulated and all this? If they can just give clarity to the formula itself, because one of the challenges or the things that we are experiencing in the municipality is the composition of the ESCO, and including the Section 80 committees and all those. But if they can just break it down and simplify it to us. Thank you.
Yes, the current situation and what the bill anticipates. Let me quickly go to the members, our counterparts from the provinces, if any comments. Yes, in that order, starting with the Eastern Cape.
Jefferson, the just two small clarifying questions. First one relates to, I think it's clause 21 that talks about the functions of the executive mayor, which the suggestion seeks to limit the executive mayor to reports from Section 8 committees. Now the question is, what happens with the reports that relate to Section 52 and 71? Is it inherent? Is it understood, or the Act does not want to explain itself? Because there is an inherent requirement. Actually, there is an organic requirement that the mayor is expected to report, quarterly performance report on Section 52, SDVIP, and as well Section 71, your financial performance on a monthly basis. And the clause seeks to suggest that only Section 80 committees. The last point, I want to establish a relationship here that there's a 20% deviation allowance that the MEC is allowed to deviate with regard to the number of councillors. Now the question is that of a relationship. What relationship does that deviation has with the what limitation by the MDP? You'll recall that by August 2019, if not July, the MDP would have concluded that process and there would have been undertakings that were required by the MEC before the sign off. Now, what relationship does this insertion in this clause has with that process?
Thank you. Honorable Member Beck, if you don't mind, just also introduce yourself.
Okay, thank you, Chair. My name is Khomotso Tong from Gauteng Province. I want to know about how does the IEC handle a situation whereby during by-election, how do they trace a person if he or she does come from that particular ward, if he is registered, or I want to know about that situation because of some people are flocking to a ward that is by-election so that they can push their candidate to win the by-election. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Jefferson. We welcome the amendments, in particular the definition of the roles and responsibilities of the WHIPs, because we think that was an area of grayness. Secondly, in relation to the MPAC, we also think that that is very, very important. The amendments that have been proposed, just one matter. A note here that the report of the MPAC must be submitted to the Speaker for tabling at the next meeting of the Municipal Council. Is there any provision made for a follow-up on that? Because the report can be tabled and then forgotten.
All right, thank you. Northwest?
Thanks, Chair. We also welcome the move to deal away with the plenary municipalities, which is something that has always created confusion.
Just raise your voice so that...
Thanks. I would say that we welcome the dealing away of the plenary municipalities. In our province, you remember that we had about three plenary municipalities wherein you become a referee and a player at the same time as a mayor and a speaker, which as a result caused confusion. But also, Chair, I want to check on 18, the establishment of the WHIP. Does municipalities automatically qualify, even if the number does not precede about 44 councillors, which I think it was a norm that you don't have a particular number of councillors for you to qualify for a WHIP? Thanks.
Just my one question. This process that we are unfolding, how will it impact on the current process, whether of the demarcation board, of finalizing the wards, and of preparing for the 2021 elections? What is your anticipation that once the process of passing the law is complete, that will be integrated within the process and the elections of 2021 would then be held in line with that, or what? All right, respond to those questions.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. Let me try my best. So, the first matter around demarcation and the time frame for demarcation and the proposal by the member that there should be a 10-year gap and you do not do it all the time. So presently we have a bill, a demarcation bill, that is going to be actually repealing the entire, well, we're proposing that the bill repeal the existing Demarcation Act in its entirety and replace it with the bill. That's the proposal. And one of the proposals in that bill is that demarcations affecting more than a ward be done every 10 years. So we've heard the Honourable Member and it is something that is being developed as we speak. The matter around the chairperson of MPAC and prescribing who should be the chair of that committee was something that was considered, but because of the organic nature of municipalities,
we see more and more coalition municipalities coming on board. I think the contestation personally is going to get greater. But it was felt that that matter could be dealt with through the rules and orders of a municipality and not necessarily in the substantive legislation or the primary legislation that we would have. We've also noted that municipalities across the country have different capabilities around the MPAC. The department, together with National Treasury, SALGA, support from donors, have also developed a toolkit around MPAC, which the department, in collaboration with these stakeholders, are in the process of rolling out. So that is happening on a continuous basis, and we do that as we get requests from municipalities, and we're out there. But second to that also is the establishment of the National Association for Municipal Public Accounts Committee. This association had taken place almost immediately after the local government elections of 2016, and it is a body made up of MPAC chairs from across the country which are being used or supporting or trying to escalate work around municipal public accounts committees. The issue around financial implications for increased numbers of councillors. Now, I gave the example of where in a municipality where the formula presently would generate a number of 30, rather than having a possibility of that 30 getting to 33, we're saying that if that municipality is greater than 20,000 square kilometers, the 33 could become 36. The 33 would have resulted in 16.5 wards, which would have been rounded up upwards, and you would have had 17 wards. The 33 to 36 would give you 18 wards, so you would find an increase of one ward from 17 to 18. So 18 would be 50% of the 36. So it is, although we say deepening democracy, we've created one ward councillor, but with that increase of the one ward councillor, we're hoping that it's going to make a difference in terms of public participation, establishment of ward committees, etc. Financial implications. So I've shown that the 20% means an increase of 3. But in these specific municipalities, we're talking about grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. So these are the poorest rural municipalities. But we must also note that when it comes to councillor remuneration, for example, these municipalities are subsidized by the National Treasury through the equitable share. So your grade 1 is subsidized to the tune of 90%, grade 2 is 80%, grade 3 is by 70% of the councillor remuneration fee, which is built into the local government equitable share. Around the formulae for the EXCO, what we have seen is that there is no uniform application of a formula. In some instances, we see that smaller parties are totally excluded from representation in the EXCO, right? They would favor themselves by exclusion. And we're saying that through the intervention of prescribing a uniform formula, representation will be extended to, if not all, most of the parties represented in the council. So we've picked up in certain municipalities that the formula that they've developed suits themselves, whereas now we're looking at a uniform application. I can go through an example, but it is quite technical. And I don't know, Chair, if it's going to help without me going through an actual slide thing, giving you numbers and showing you a breakdown.
I think suffices it. A matter of big debate,
yeah,
in terms of how
the EXCO must be constituted, whether the current formula is it right or it must be amended in the way that you are suggesting, yes. Say, matter that will take form.
Yes. So it's a simple formula of the number of seats that has been won by the political party divided by the total number of councillors in that municipality times the size of the EXCO. So it's a simple computation. I think the matter raised also by the Honourable Member around the 20% deviation for ward delimitation. 20% sounds like 100% increase from 10%. But if you look at it, 33 to 36, 17 wards, 18 wards, it is not really a big change in terms of 10% jumping to a 20% deviation. And as I've indicated, it is only the 9 municipalities in the country that would be falling into this category of more than 20,000 square kilometers in terms of size. Mr. Shaburi would respond to the issue around ward voting in different wards and different municipalities. Sorry, the colleague, the Honourable Member also raised the issue of Section 71 of the Structures Act, and I just had a quick look at it. And
to Section 71 of the Systems Act.
I think
no,
so.
MFMA.
Yes.
MFMA, not...
You're quite right, Chair, because when I looked at 71, it deals with sub-councils in metropolitan municipalities. The Honourable Member raised the issue of follow-up. It's something that we would need to consider, very important, because you just don't want something to be tabled and for it to be parked thereof. There needs to be consequence management and monitoring of implementation of resolution. The requirement around the 40 councillors, so you would recall that that requirement is in the policy framework for full-time councillors. It is provided for in the Structures Act, but the policy framework is done by notice in the Gazette, and if through a process of consultation it is seen that that requirement needs to be changed, then that would follow a different process outside of this. Then, Chairperson, around the implications for the 2021 election. The electoral-related amendments in the bill would require that it be in place before the elections because there are formula in there that could be necessary or required, especially around excessive seats if a challenge is picked up in municipalities. And I'm not going to get into that because Mr. Shaburi would be able to talk more intelligently about that. But when it comes to prescribing the minimum of 10 councillors in a municipality, the implication for ward delimitation, etc., one would know that in May or June of last year, could be July, the Minister had published a notice in the Gazette prescribing formulae for the number of councillors of municipalities. That process has been finalised. So after that notice was published, MECs had determined the number for each municipality in the country. And that process then lends itself into the demarcation board's process of delimiting wards. So, for example, Joburg has 270 councillors, it has 135 wards. That process of delimiting wards has commenced already. So although this bill, when once enacted, may have implications, those things could be dealt with through transitional arrangements, but such things having such implications would take effect at the commencement of the next local government elections. So I think I've responded to all of the questions raised, say, for the IEC dealing with one or two matters.
IEC, especially that question of people voting not in their wards, simply put, there's a judgment of the Concord in respect of that. Maybe you can speak to it.
Thank you, Chair, for that guidance. I wasn't sure because the administration of election falls under a different scheme. It is not implicated by what we are discussing today. But let me say this. The Honourable Member raises a question for which political parties are responsible. It relates to what we colloquially refer to as the passing in of voters, where a political party purposefully goes canvasses persons that are outside the wards with the purpose of those persons registering in a different ward so that they can pervert the outcome of an election by participating in an election in which they are not entitled. As you correctly state, Chair, in the seminal judgment in Kam and Mthop, the Constitutional Court set the parameters for an address. It says as follows. One, the import of an address is to facilitate canvassing by political parties and contestants, and the twin effect of that is that it is intended to keep persons that are ordinarily not resident within the boundaries of the ward, and thereby only facilitate the participation of persons that are registered in the ward. The court, however, went forward to say proof of registration or proof of an address is not a condition precedent to a registration of a vote. And that is telling because in our constitutional scheme, Chair, the voter's roll must be common. It must not, you must not end up on the voter's roll because of a peculiar or special qualifying feature like proof of an address. Again, the court said the Electoral Commission has no obligation or it is not under duty to make sure that the address exists, two, that the address belongs to the vote. With that in mind, we however take specific measures to track, especially for by-elections, the re-registration of persons. So we have a voter trail from the first time on each voter since we compiled the voters' roll in 1998. So where there's organized migration of voters, it raises questions and we investigate those things. But we also provide to all political parties and contestants, including independent candidates, the voters' roll that is going to be used for that election, and we provide a window period for them to inspect the roll and to raise objections against the inclusion or exclusion of certain persons on the segment of the voters' roll to enable us to take decisions on whether a person has been passed into that ward and therefore entitled to participate. Just to say, we have live cases as we speak of such instances that we've picked up in a number of by-elections, and invariably in all those people that you've caused to be arrested, the fingers point to political parties having organized such behavior.
Right, so far so good.
Oh, you wanted to come back?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
See, I think I've misunderstood or I misunderstood the response. I would have been very comfortable if the storyline would have said what is raised in the amendment has no implication to other original requirements of other pieces of legislation. When it says the executive mayor is expected to as part of his or her functions to receive only Section 80 committee reports. Because in this case, it is not implicated, and I'm fine. But if it's implicated, I'll be very comfortable to say that clause must be expanded to give meaning to other requirements of the mayor in terms of other legislative requirement by law that he or she is required to report. Section 52, SDBIB is her responsibility of the MFMA. Section 71, MFMA is her responsibility. Now, I would be happy if the storyline concludes by saying all what was saying in the structure and amendment bill does not have implication for other requirements elsewhere. Not to leave as if I was referring to the Structures Act. That's not the issue. That was not the intention. I think I was very clear, Chair.
Is at the point clear that because it is about reporting to council by the mayor, it must be clear that that doesn't exclude other processes, including Section 52 and Section 71 of the Municipal Finance Management Act. Is that what you said? That's the essence, yes. Good. right? This is a process as well. Or you are coming, we have 5 minutes to conclude.
Sorry, Chairperson, I omitted.
If
you know the whilst we welcome the establishment of the MPAC and the powers that are given to it, I think one of the deficiencies is that these MPACs don't have the required technical support to do their work. It's a complaint that comes right away all the time. And in some way, I'm not sure where, but there has to be some provision made, whether it's through COCTA or whatever. But there has to be technical support provided to them, or they can't do their work.
I'm sure that's the purpose of legislating formally the establishment of MPACs, so that they are properly staffed like all other, what you call them, office bearers within council, yes. The last point.
No. Thanks, Chair. I just want just to put a follow-up question quickly to IEC. When they pick up the movement that he mentioned in the response, since they started compiling the voters, is that information being made available to political parties, especially before by-elections? Because they are the ones who are on the ground every time, and they know different movements, and those things are being reported to IEC at times, and we don't get clear answers with regard to that. Thank you.
Is that clear? Do you want to say something on that? Because the point that he's raising is very valid, that the movement of people must be tracked. Voter A has moved to voter B, to voting station B, and so on and so forth. You can say something on that. You can comment.
Thanks, Chair. And that's legitimate. There are many cases where the movement is legitimate. The person has changed addresses. We are only looking at those who re-register while they still remain in their old ward of registration. You would recall that after a long time, we were able to constitute two municipalities in northern KZN, primarily because the challenges related to the voters' roll, where people knowingly registered in a ward in which they are not ordinary residents with the purpose of procuring an advantage for their political cause. What we've done there, we've gone on a campaign with political parties where we went house to house, door to door, verifying against what the Concord told us is not as important, the registration and address of each vote. While that is possible in a single by-election, it is not possible to do the same when you are confronted with a general election of all municipalities to make sure that a voter is indeed registered in each of the addresses that they provide. But we've instituted for both by-elections, general elections, the period of objections. We place the voters' roll, we give it to political parties, we give it to all contestants so that they can then inspect the segments of the roll and raise objections against the correctness or otherwise of persons who appear on those segments.
All right. No, thank you very much for the presentations.
Chair.
Are you burning?
Yeah.
Unless you are burning, I'll allow you. Are you burning?
No, I'm not burning really. I just wanted to.
Okay.
I'm not answering. In my question, I said, is that information provided to political parties where they pick up those movements?
Affirmative, Chair. We table those in the local PLC meetings of the involved by election.
Yeah, I'm sure one day we must call a meeting of both the demarcation board, the department, and the IEC to come and talk about, more especially as we move towards the local government elections. Because one of the major problems that political parties pick up is the inability of the IEC to provide even the voters' rolls to political parties on time so that they can make this verification that Honorable Zandamela is talking about. There will always be movement of people from one place and the other, register from this ward, deregister, go to another ward. And the point is that information must be made available, and that indication must be spelled out. that how many people move from one point to the other. And I think that is the gist of the question. But having said that, let me thank the department once more for the presentation. And this as well is going to follow the same process where we advertise, solicit the comments of the people. As you can see, there are about 32 clauses which must be encapsulated in the new amendment version of the Municipal Structures Act. And that must be taken into consideration. There would necessarily be a lot of engagement, a lot of interest, because local government is very, very much key. And these amendments in the main, as honorable members have expressed, they speak largely to the separation of power within the municipalities, plenary type of municipalities, defining the role of the speaker, of the mayor, and establishing the MPEG and establishing the right committees that must do their work. And that speaks to how the whole system has evolved over time, and I think at some point there is a need of that intervention to make sure that local government functions and it functions optimally and its structures are in the position to perform their work in order to achieve the developmental objectives of local government. In that sense, thank you very much for the presentation. That's a way forward. Immediately after that process, we'll call you again to interact with this process. Our wish is that we must expedite it so that it mustn't negatively impact on the work of the elections and everything that has got to do with the 2021 elections must be covered and be taken care of. On that note, thank you very much. Our colleagues from different provinces for honoring our invitation, the department, the ministry and two departments. Thank you very much for coming and everybody else, members of parliament. Thank you very much for honoring this invitation and participating effectively as you did. On that note, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.